to get all the goodies. City Lights Bookshop has a book called The Protection, Journal Protection of All Beings. I wrote a short story about 2 months ago. I picked this book and I see a poem by Thomas Merton. I said, dig the same kind of writing in the abstract. A letter form, the short story I wrote. Chick, husband is in the joint, right? She's going to talk to somebody who'll understand. Listen, God. He'll listen, he had a kid of his own. Dear God, my husband is in the joint. He is and was a soldier, like Private Willie Slovak. There was a lot of heat, and somebody had to take a tumble, so was my old man. Now, he's a good old man. Don't listen to me, just ask the kids. He was a good, obedient soldier, and he wasn't, I feel, as heinous as that man who dropped that pterodactyl branch egg over Hiroshima and burned the lids away from those thousand almond eyes, but he's the kind of a soldier that made a good husband. Don't take him away. Who will maybe unlatch my bra? Please don't make that other pillow obsolete. Don't take my old man away. Don't. Let me plead the fifth. I'll plead the fifth, dear God. You know what the fifth is? Thou shalt not kill. Maybe that'll cook. Don't take him away. I love him. Yours truly, Mrs. Adolf Eichmann. Yeah.
People are amateurs.
Kind of disturbing, right?
Well, they're approaching it in completely like the wrong way, you know. I mean,
so the story behind this is that so in the video there is a comic named Ari Scheffer, who I just stumbled upon the other day, who I'm a big stand-up comedian fan. Listened to many, many hours, and over the years, you know, I went from Dennis Miller to Chris Rock, found myself into George Carlin, and then ultimately found my way into Lenny Bruce. And when I found Lenny Bruce, I was like, oh, so this is where it all started, at least the voice of American comedy to me. You know, the guy who just doesn't do bits, but who can go on and just wail, you know, just his thoughts go from his mind to his mouth, and he's always connecting things, and it's that jazz kind of thing, and it's beautiful stuff. So I always check, you know, iTunes, top 10 comics, or whatever the new comedy albums are, just to see what's new, what's the new voice out there. And I had never heard his name before, and he has an album called Revenge for the Holocaust, or whatever. And he has a track on there called Shrooms. And he's like, if you haven't tried shrooms, you haven't lived. And I didn't buy the album. I just heard, like, you know, a 60-second clip. But the internet's weird because you just type in his name and then you discover he has, you know, a podcast with 80 different episodes. You can find YouTube clips of him. So after about 3 hours, I had listened to about 3 hours of material from this guy. And he's very much in the school of Daniel Tosh and sort of Dane Cook, but sort of like, it's your fault if you don't get that it's all a joke. He does a bit called The Amazing Racist, where he sets up, you know, it's complete satire, where he goes in dressed as a geisha girl into a Chinese restaurant and offends everybody. Real just, you know, kind of not amateur, but you get what I'm saying. He's like a hate comic, but it's your fault if you think it's hate. I don't think this way. So I'm getting this impression of what this comic is. And he's very quick. He's very smart. You can tell he can think on his feet. But the waters he swims in, just not necessarily what I would listen to. And I automatically think of, you know, how sad it is that Lenny Bruce, you know, was considered a sick comic back in the 60s. And nowadays, a guy like this Ari Scheffer can do his material. And if you had to force a label on someone as a sick comic, you know, a lot of his humor could be considered sick. And Lenny definitely was fighting against a system. A lot of that kind of thing. So mm-hmm. I see this clip, Ari Shaffir on Salvia, and I go, I want to see what happens, if I want to see if it happens to him when he smokes it, because I had the feeling that if he went where I went and he came out of it, he would be apt to describe it explicitly, or it would inform his material as, holy shit, this isn't, you know, like, he's a truth teller, or he tells truth in different ways. And I knew that if he smoked this material, he would turn on to that place. So I almost half expected the reaction that you see in that video. What surprises me is that that short video clip is part of a longer podcast, and he's pretty whacked out. He's pretty beat up. He doesn't really speak to the experience with the kind of lucid thought that I would expect out of him, just coming from his stand-up material.
Well,
the way that
right after you got it, you're not supposed to, like, basically with that, you want to approach, if you're very sensitive to your surroundings and the initial letting go into. I have a friend who was just about to take a hit, and another friend of mine said, "Don't smoke that."
Like, oh, super, God.
Like, intensely, because he had just had a hit, and he was trying to, and it's his girlfriend, he was trying to stop her, and he ends up getting up and running into a wall, like, fucking, fence that he saw a portal in, and just, like, get up and run away from the circle of people, and then she had, you know, taken a hit, large hit, and then basically went into the house and had to hold her face together. Her face was literally falling apart. And she's legit. She's like what do you call it? Basically, she's very, very experienced in that realm. But she said it was the only time in her life that she's ever forgotten that she took something. She just saw that this is what's happening. She's trying to keep her face from fucking falling apart, and that there's basically like gears and wheels within her face. It's like holding reality together, and you know, she's just totally, totally traumatizing event. And then I have another friend who smoked it and thought that it was DMT. Who wasn't this person wasn't experienced. He thought it was DMT up until when he talked to me about it. He's working next at the place next door to me, and I'd gone to high school with this guy. And he's telling me he's seen eyeballs popping out of everything. And he's like, I've been seeing eyeballs ever since I had this experience, like, fucking 3-4 months ago or whatever it was. And I'm like, what was it? And he was like, yeah, I smoked DMT. And I'm like, and then he's describing this whole thing and how he's having these lasting effects. I'm like, this doesn't sound right. What did your DMT look like? And he was like, oh, well, it was green and leafy. I'm like, you smoked salvia. And he took like 10 hits or something. He just took hit after hit after hit and just completely tweaked him out. So, you know, like, I don't know. It's just, it's one of those things where it's like, there's certain drugs out there that have the effects that they have, but they don't, they're not as, traumatic, in the same way, and they don't have as like lasting hallucinations that keep coming up that can be scary. So the scary hallucination tip, you know, and then some people smoke and it's fine, you know, whatever, you know, I mean, it's not fine, but it's like they endure it and they go on with their lives, you know. But I think that there's better drugs to take in that regard. I don't know what person's after, you know.
Well, but,
I don't touch it personally,
but to tie it back to the whole American Beauty thing is, what if you could genetically engineer salvia to, and it might be a false statement and it might be impossible to compare this, but to take away the paranoia so that one could have that intense dissolution, find yourself in that transformative reality, but not that urge you see people to run. That they're looking for any sense of control over their environment because they can't think it away. They can't close their eyes because they don't have eyes anymore. There's no time and space. They're just in this environment. And if you could remove, is it possible that the paranoia is something to be extracted, removed, or it's sort of an element that is undesired with that plant and that experience? And that to remove it, you could create the G13 of salvia.
Cool. I mean, a lot of the paranoia is what people bring to it at the same time. With that, it seems like there's certain things that are just a reflection of your own consciousness. So if you're experiencing terror in the first place, it just becomes more terror, you know. So there's that. Because, I mean, I've talked to people who haven't had that negative experience, too. It's just, you know, hearing it from my good friend that she sees her face falling apart, you know. But that was also initiated with her casually taking a hit of this while she's on LSD at the same time, basically having a friend shout, "Don't smoke that," like, really loud, like, right as she's smoking it, like, and he's totally terrified. So that's like kind of throws things off, I think, but I don't know. It's tricky. That guy in that video, that was the worst conditions ever. He's on a radio show and has people fucking shouting at him the whole time. It's just like, "It's okay, it's okay, it's okay." It's like, dude, it's like, yeah, it's just awful circumstance. So.
Oh, the worst. The audio in the podcast continues where some guy keeps saying, "I don't think you took enough. I think you need to take another hit." And just continually kind of fucking with a guy who just, in my opinion, went through about as heavy of a spiritual initiatory rite as it gets. I mean, the name is appropriate, I think, if you take the right bent on it. It is a salvation. It can be a salvation. But
it's interesting that's legal.
No, it's bizarre, man. It's bizarre.
Why is that legal and, like, so many things aren't? Like, I don't, that's just super weird to me. It's like encouraging people to, like, "Oh, yeah, that's fine."
But if people learn how to use it, you know, it's like, there's so many videos on the internet, there's so much information out there, and yet these adults, those are adults in that room. Those are not kids. And there's seemingly no self-awareness as to what they're putting it, like a loaded gun in front of someone's face, chemically or, you know, plant-based, but and saying, "We want you to shoot your head off, you know. We know what this can do to you. We want this to happen to you. We want to laugh at you because it's just funny." And it's, I just don't get that detachment, you know, complete and utter detachment. Now, this guy, this comedian, there's a clip of him where there's a heckler in the audience, and his retort, as funny as it is, "I hope when you leave here you get raped continuously by a bunch of different people." Now, I might be paraphrasing and not using the exact same words, but the sentiment of the joke is, "You're a slut and a whore. I hope that when you leave here, you get raped." Because everyone, that's funny. That's so funny. And I'm just imagining when you're going through the crisis of a salvia experience, I wonder if that kind of moment echoes through that comic's mind, thinking about, what the fuck am I saying? I mean, the people in the room who are fucking with him are doing the exact same thing he was doing on stage. That really, man, when he comes out of it and he can laugh about it ultimately, we're really not doing anything bad.
What affects you with experiences like that are the accumulation of an overall approach to the world and your surroundings, and people are included within that. So it's like, if you, you know, repeatedly are instilling a interpretation that is removed from reality, like one of where you're on a high seat of judgment, which is obscuring your own ability to reflect upon yourself and your own tendencies, which, you know, like emotional intelligence tends to be pretty lacking. But the less emotional intelligence one has, the more in those kinds of, like you said, initiatory rights, you know, basically the harder those hit you, the less you're in touch with yourself emotionally. So, and then if he's playing a role and he's joking and somebody's drunk and they're fucking with him and he's turning the tables onto them, that's one thing. If he actually in himself is projecting that kind of removal from reality onto the person, that's another issue altogether. But you can't tell that from the outside. Like, you don't know where somebody's at and what their intentions actually are, where things are coming from, just from like a superficial observation. You know, you don't know. You can't weigh someone's soul based on an instance. That's an accumulatory effect from their own living patterns, you know, that develops into their identity. So who knows, you know. If you could, I'd like you to watch this video that I put up here that Jake Kotza did. It's one of my absolute favorite Kotza videos that deals with Eyes Wide Shut. And I'm going to go use the restroom and I'll be back.
All right, dude.
Play me some beautiful, dreamy music, dear Prince.
Hey.
Subconscious mind, my lords, my ladies, gentlemen. Have you ever swung along a beautiful country road with a gleam of sweet life in the air? Groovy with gold in your pocket, riding a wild set of wheels at an easy pace. Are you there? Everything is smooth and cool. There's some traffic, but not too much traffic. But it's all right, you see, because you've got everything covered. Understand? You're driving along in the feel of the sun and the radio swinging a beautiful, crazy, wild tune. And you feel so good, you feel right in there, tight. Can you feel it? Yes. And suddenly your mind goes over to Hidleyville. And you start thinking about a beautiful girl that you met there 5 years ago. And what a gasser she was. Oh, God, take me now! Beautiful. Have your nose rubbed in a rose garden so many roses you can't till later. You've been thinking about how charming she was, how gracious her people were, what a ball you had, what a beautiful time, how sweet, how generous, how crazy, how like a home in a home in a home in a home home. Kick it was. And you've got to think of how you went out to the lake and you... Ooh, man. Yes, 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 yes. Yes, yes, yes. And you go many, many other places along that Rosetta, the Reverie Creek, and all of a sudden you say, what am I doing? Wait a minute. Is everything all right? I haven't hit anything. I don't think I have. No. Those fenders all right? Yes. Good. Excellent. Well, better watch what I'm doing here. Who do you think's been driving while you were gone?
The Red Door.
Did you finish it?
Yeah.
Pretty good, huh? Shoot. Over there looking for my American Beauty record. So what'd you think? You liked it.
Obviously. Well, It didn't, like, no lightning flash for me with that, you know. Didn't speak to me all too loud and clear, but that doesn't mean that another viewing wouldn't elicit more reaction from me. I guess, to be fair, my reaction... I mean... So the red door of the house would clearly be Kevin Spacey's blown-out third eye, because that's prominently featured in American Beauty. Jeffrey Combs connected in with his reanimator, which is funny. I mean, I saw that movie like 5 or 6 times as a kid, one of the first truly gory movies, and definitely a movie that stood out on its own. It was like, where did this come from? I mean... It's gory, but it's funny, it's smart, it just had an element to it that separated itself from most of the things that I had watched when I was 12 or 13. I don't know. What does it say to you? I mean...
I just like the further... 'cause I was already... Before I saw that video, I was tripping out on the fact that like how symbolic it is that Kevin Spacey happens to get shot in the way that he gets shot. And the way, like, everything about that is just super symbolic. And so, you know, I found it very interesting that he took this, like, I don't know, this kind of crazy hopping on the lily pad sink route, just classic maneuver, tying all these things together, and then what do you know, it all comes down to the pineal gland in that way. And the fact that he H.P. Lovecraft, like, I have never looked into that much H.P. Lovecraft in my life, but my friends who have, like, I can see they take, like, he's definitely a cornerstone of something in that realm, so in sci-fi and whatnot. So I don't know, I don't know what you call it, sci-fi. So what's the deal? H.P. Lovecraft wrote the Necronomicon?
Yeah, it's a fake text, right?
And that's all H.P. Lovecraft, right?
That's what I was led to believe.
Okay, so that's just, like, super interesting in terms of, okay, so H.P. Lovecraft did the Necronomicon, and then obviously you have, which is supposed to be a real text beyond him, that there was this Necronomicon, but then, like, with Evil Dead 2, and Evil Dead with the Necronomicon, that's, like, the gateway to hell, which definitely reminds me of, like, Roman Polanski's The Ninth Gate. In its own way, that it's like he's this whole book situation and he's got the keys, and then obviously that one's super potent because it has the Hebrew letter Tet repeated on there, and then obviously you have the Beast of the Apocalypse, and then the woman is verified as the Scarlet Woman who Johnny Depp has sex with, and then you can see the link between the Scarlet Woman in the Ninth Gate and Rosemary's Baby with her in her red dress right before she is led into that whole ritual, the not red dress, but the red onesie, which was pointed out by Jason Barrera, which I was thinking as well, with A Clockwork Orange, that the woman who gets raped is wearing this red onesie.
Okay.
So help us see that. And then he was writing about that this morning. And it's just, I was definitely like inevitably equating both women with this Scarlet Woman in that way. Like, it just seems like this whole thing. And then that's, you know, there's all this symbolism there. But I don't know. I was just looking at the rose itself as an extension of the same thing. And then you have, obviously, it's not like, it's not a mistake. It's over the roses. Like, he gets shot and it's like... You know, and then obviously you have the new we have to talk about Kevin. We need to talk about Kevin deal.
I have yet to see that.
Okay. Well, that is basically like, you know, whatever. I don't want to spoil it for you, but
Kevin Spacey?
That's the thing. So it's like Kevin, and they do the same thing with the symbolism, with this red business, like repeatedly throughout the film. Like they show her face with the tomato soup behind her, Tilda Swinton, and then like this, just this red rum, over and over and over again, and they just play with this whole theme. It's just very very effective on an artistic level, but at the same time, it seems like there's just some kind of esoteric.
Okay, walk me through this real quick, because for me, the red and the blue is on the Tree of Life. Red is severity, right? Which is
Gavora,
and blue is on the other side,
mercy, which is chesed.
Chesed, right? So you have Gavura and chesed. And this is where our country is at right now, with the red states and the blue states.
Sure. Everything's blue and red.
Everything is blue and red. It's the foundation.
Right. And it's the 3D glasses.
Okay, beautiful. And Breaking Bad is a show that plays well with this. But because of the blue and red in Chesed and Gevura, I've been focusing on how people use purple, as if purple is the healthy compromise. If we can't have all red state, we can't have all blue state, purple will be our compromise. But purple is not an elevation. It's falling. But I don't have anything to back that up. I've just been running with the concepts there and trying to find my own way through it, and then try to find it represented somewhere else.
Jung talked about the purple thing, what you're talking about. I mean, a number of people have pointed that out. There's like, and then also like a new agey like thing. They say to meditate on purple. It's like straight out of Saint Germain's ideas. But the reason I know that Jung talked about that the way he did was because of a book by Daphne Moore called The Rabbi's Tarot, which is based on a manuscript by one of Jung's close correspondences, one of his, I guess you could even go so far to call disciples, because he had a small group of students that were more in the inner circle of his school and got way more into tarot with, specifically writer tarot, and his approach to the colors and whatnot. And purple is a very rare color in writer tarot, but it does occur. So, and actually Jodorowsky in his book on tarot says the same thing here. That purple is like just what you're saying. It's the reconciliation and the middle path and all of this business. So, I mean, it's the only way beyond is, first of all, directly through the polarity. So what the polarity that's taken as a conflict, so the contrast that's taken as a conflict is reconciled through the middle path, through the merging of the opposites. And so like this whole thing with the opposites, like you can even see like in Holy Mountain where the character lets his crucified version of himself go on blue and red balloons. He's got one blue side and one red side and lets it go. And that's the whole thing of that. It's in the merging of the opposites that we're able to transcend. It's a super basic symbolic repeated theme.
In the Breaking Bad show, the main character, Walter White, who lives in the White House, his alter ego is Heisenberg, who makes this near-perfect methamphetamine, which is blue as opposed to regular methamphetamine. Mm-hmm. And it's 99.1% pure. And the way I'm reading that is that, you know, this man who lives from the White House, Walter White, known as Heisenberg, he has seen the perfect formula for the capitalist structure in America. And so the perfect formula is to have the entire country go blue. So every state is on the blue formula, but it's still a 99.1%. So you still have the 99% and the 1%. So if in the election Obama gets elected and every state goes blue, that means everyone should be happy. Well, we all agree on one thing, that we don't want red states, we want blue states. So everyone on the surface sees a whole united country in blue, and they think, okay, this is good. But yet the 99% and the 1% that everyone has protested against, that still remains under the surface. That people will forget about 99 and 1 if everything goes blue. And that Walter White, this is his perfect formula for basically running the show. You know, or his ascent to empire, or his belief in empire. The alternative to that seemingly is, I don't know, I haven't gotten that far. But, I mean, shitload going on with that show Breaking Bad. I mean,
the 2-1-4 thing that everyone was going off about for a while there, so it's kind of appropriate, like you're breaking the code, so to speak, or something. I don't know. I haven't seen the show, but
it's pretty genius. Pretty genius. Well, he's dropped some heavyweight shining stuff in there, like in a scene, a guy calls on KDK-12. KDK, he hits the KDK thing.
Oh, for real?
Yeah. And the next
KDK-12 is actually, they have that in the show. They say that.
Yeah, and it's just a really very quick nod. I mean, if you don't know, you don't know. You just wouldn't see it. Right. There's a very prominent scene where Walter White completely loses it, and he's framed like the final shot of The Shining. It's beautiful, really. It's one of the most haunting scenes I've ever seen in a television show ever. I mean, just the most gorgeous display of pure madness. But this guy, Vince Gilligan, he used to write for The X-Files. And this show is like it's all about the formula. And, like, there's a lawyer that they go to who is a fake Jewish lawyer. And his office is the steps of the Lincoln Monument and the Constitution all around him. Whatever. I can't just, you know, completely encapsulate it here. But there is a character in there who's always wears purple, and she is the wife of a law enforcement agent. And I guess I was just sort of bringing all this hunk of unconnected stuff to say, you have your red, you have your blue, and purple's somewhere in the middle. But where does the green fit in? Is the green? It escapes me right now, but it seems that like the green and gold is an antithesis of the purple, and I'm not sure if that fits in to a system somewhere or that rings any bells for you.
The gold?
Well, I associate green and gold together, and the purple is separate from the green and gold. And this is really just spinning thoughts off the top of my head
I'm working on. No, I can consider that, like, the Emerald City is all green and gold, and that the Emerald City itself represents paper currency, and you have the yellow brick road, which is obviously gold, leading to it. And there's this association there that it's like the one leads to the other, but one is like a substitute version that's like a lesser reality of the other, and that and yet it makes everything possible. It's basically turning to illusion to fill in the rest or something. There's kind of an interesting relationship there. I take one as like the sun and reality, it's a solar thing, and then the other is like its other representational deal. So then that gets interesting in terms of the meanings of dark side of the moon. There's no dark side of the moon, really. As a matter of fact, it's all dark. It's like there's no reality to gold being anything in the first place, other than, you know, I guess you could say it's still, I don't know. People have different ideas about the value of gold, you know, but I don't know. I could see that kind of. I don't know.
Yeah.
I want to propose an experiment here. Cool. I'm not sure exactly how to go about this, but I've been wanting to do this for a while, and I haven't gotten around to it. It's playing Grateful Dead, American Beauty with American Beauty, and my curious thing. I doubt it'll align this way, but I have this kind of like hopeful thought about how to play with you like Pink Floyd. I like a lot of music. If there was actually like an alignment that allowed for that to be the changeover, I don't know if that's how close that is in the middle of the film or in terms of timing or something, because I know American Beauty isn't that long of an album. It'd be interesting. I don't know. Adam Hart Mother or something. I think it'd be fun to just experiment with American Beauty in the first place.
You know, it's funny because I was eventually going to hopefully remember to bring that up, because I was going to ask you, had you overlaid any music to American Beauty? It sounds like possibly that's untouched territory for you right now. You haven't worked with American Beauty in an album?
I when it first came out, played, I think it was, the reason I said Adam Hart Mother is because I think I played it with Adam Hart Mother a long time ago, just for fun. But I haven't tried it with American Beauty. I think that would be very appropriate. So I don't know. It just sounds like a little fun experiment there.
Well, and I was thinking American Beauty into something by Townsend.
Right. The album that has The Seeker on it, that The Seeker was first on, was Meaty, Beady, Big
and Bouncy. And Bouncy. Yeah.
with these orphans on the front. And they're like, you know, peeking out the window looking at these orphans. And then in the reverse side of the album, you have the orphans peeking out the window looking at The Who. It's like they've switched roles, which is interesting. It definitely reminds me of Dark Side of the Moon, in the way that you have one triangle facing one way and then you flip it and you have the lines actually connect, so that the beam actually connects and the rainbow actually connects, and it's a forward facing triangle. It's this whole reversal idea, which is really like almost like a magical formula to do that, to have this opposite side. You know, and then if you look at Grateful Dead, American Beauty album, it's not necessarily a reversal, but you can see that they have the same exact motif on both sides. So you flip it and you have this kind of like parallel thing.
And you go from color to black and white. I mean,
go from color to black and white, which is like just like Dark Side of the Moon goes from a white beam into the color and then back again. It's this whole loop idea, which is perfect for if you're wanting to flip you flip the record in the first place if you listen to it, but then to be that you keep flipping it, if you like Dark Side of the Moon with Wizard of Oz, you flip the record, that the last sequence of the film, the result from doing that is like the best fucking part. When she lands back in her bed and it says home, home again, I like,
yes,
to be here.
Yeah, no.
Like, oh! You're like, oh, that's why it didn't make as much sense the first time around, because she wasn't fucking home yet.
Yeah. You know,
like, yeah.
It's amazing to revisit something like that and remember just the beauty of those home runs that are hit during that sequence. It's kind of ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
So, okay, yeah. You know what I think would be interesting? Yeah, I'll fuck around with the American Beauty, and find some kind of tandem to it. I'm interested to see where Candyman comes in.
Yeah, I'm just looking at this is such a good fucking album, The Who.
Yeah.
I can't explain. Kids Are All Right, but Happy Jack, My Generation, I Can See for Miles.
So it's a compilation.
Pinball Wizard. Yeah, it's a compilation album. Mm-hmm. But isn't this the first one that The Seeker came out on? Or no?
I always thought The Seeker was on Quadrophenia, but...
Oh, I'm making assumptions that are wrong. Okay, The Seeker, The Who. Sorry about that. See, I'm not that huge. I haven't been that huge of a Who fan. I got into Tommy when I was younger, just the, you know, obviously the rock opera movie, but I didn't, I haven't followed The Who like I have other bands.
I'm not right on The Seeker. That is not on Quadrophenia. You might be correct.
Dolly Parton, The Seeker? No, this can't be. The Who. Okay. The Seeker is a song written by Pete Townsend who performed.
Yeah, you're right.
What is this Dolly Parton business? What the fuck are they talking about? See, I don't know any Who? Anything? What if? See the Seeker? Oh, no, they said a whole other song. I'm sorry. I was okay. Like, what are they saying with fucking Dolly Parton? But no, Dolly Parton did another song called The Seeker.
Heat Seekers.
It says, and performed by English rock band The Who and featured on their 1971 compilation album, Meaty, Beaty, Big, and Bouncy.
God, it's so weird to believe that Dolly Parton is real. I mean,
she got a breast reduction.
I mean, back in the day, just like, so bizarre. What a weird world. So The Seeker was just an unreleased track that they featured on as like a new song on Meaty Beaty Big and Bouncy. There you go.
Yeah, it was right. Yeah, I felt like that was true, but I'm not like, I wouldn't want to be having to do Who trivia because I don't think I would do very well. But yeah, that is actually true. It was on this album. And this album is like a really... I don't know. I've definitely you can visualize it. You know this album?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, they're funny. They're fucking weirdos.
Yeah, no. You know, out of all the rock biographies that have been coming out lately, I definitely would like to read Townsend's because he just strikes me as someone who just despises bullshit and really never felt at home in the world he found himself in as being famous and all that shit. And I imagine he pretty much just goes for it in his autobiography. Doesn't really hold anything back. Yeah, he's an odd one for sure.
In front of this door. He's trying to read on the door what the address is. I think it says 123. Whatever. You know, this is a compilation album, and the Shining sync that I did with the Doors, that all came together with a compilation album, which is crazy.
That's a fucking weird compilation album, though.
It's 13. And that was the only compilation album that was made while Jim Morrison was alive. So he approved that album, and that was the album that pictures the Doors on the back surrounding a stone bust of Aleister Crowley. And the album is called 13, which is death, right? Like, it's just, and whatever, a coven of witches and, you know, Jesus and his disciples and Ophiuchus being the 13th sign of the zodiac and all these things, you know, leading to 13. 13 is a very potent thing, but just like name the album 13. And then if you look at the cover of the Doors 13, it is the exact reversal of their debut album, just the Doors. And so in the way that the Doors is black, like shadow with his face with one eye, you know, going into the, coming out of the blackness, right? So you have this one eye thing. And then in The Doors 13, you have the Doors, the other members of the Doors walking away from Jim Morrison while he has his face turned towards the light. Like, it's the exact opposite, like, of that, of their first album. So you see, like, it's almost like they completed the cycle. That album gives the feeling, like, for me, that he knew he was going to pass. It's just like, it's almost like a magical record. And they never came out with it on, they never digitized it. And so when I wanted to reproduce it for the video, I actually had to go, and I never put the whole thing up, even though I have it in my computer, because I was having issues with Vimeo at the time, because I didn't have that good of internet access when I first started that, and we upgraded, whatever. Anyways, I had to go. I was working here in town, and I was moving from this other place, and I was spending all this time with my girlfriend, and I actually had to drive back and forth into the mountains just to get the timing right, to literally time with seconds, to basically mimic the LP. And get versions that were the exact same versions. And there's a fade out with two songs, but one was especially Light My Fire. They do a different fade out on that record than they do anywhere else. And so I had to reproduce the fade out to keep the timing exactly the same, because I kept on trying to watch it with the movie. I was like, this isn't the timing that I saw. And so the LP was different. And in order to get the, and so, and it all comes down to this, because I'm playing three records with this film. And if I want the end to end the way the end ended, that's just the most epic part of the whole thing, which you've seen. You know what I'm talking about, right? You saw the end with The Shining. Did you watch that? Oh, I can't hear you. Is your sound off?
Sorry. That's on Vimeo, right? The end with...
Yeah.
I have to watch that. Because okay. I don't have... whatever. I got to watch that.
Yeah, sure. But that's the best part, is the end. And so it was weird that the timing, until I got it exactly the same as the LP, you know, it threw me off. And so, like, this is funny. Like, I'd be interested to play this with it, because... Did they, I mean, I'm sure the Who probably digitized this compilation mm-hmm. record, but is it the exact same timing? So, like, I went through, we were having this discrepancy with Rosemary's Baby with my timing mm-hmm. situation, and so I made sure I went just to Wikipedia, because you can see the exact LP times on Wikipedia for the White Album, and I went through and checked with my copy that it's exactly the same, and it is. But there's examples of things where it's not, because I went and I downloaded like five different versions of Double Fantasy, just because I wanted to play it with the film. But it's all, every version that I downloaded was slightly different. 5 to 10 seconds difference in the songs. And there's like, there's a version of it called Stripped Down, but then even the regular versions were different than the LP. So I was just like, oh, well, that sucks. I need to play it with the LP. So if I was to put that together and want to put it up on Vimeo, I would want to have it exactly the same as the LP. Because that's like part of like a scientific approach to it. It's the best degree that I'm able is like, if, not to say it's intentional, but if it was intentional, what would it look like? Yeah. Like when this gets digitally changed and down the road and different timing will make sense fucking years later. No, they're like... LP now, what does it look like?
Yeah,
is exactly the same, right? So you know, you don't because they did a thing where the song fades into the next song. There's no cut in between, and so it's going to have the same time, you know. And they make sure of that it's like at the beginning of Rosemary's Baby where they have the dun dun with Paramount. They'll never change that because it's part of the movie. They made it part of the movie. You're not going to have a different Paramount intro, you know?
Well, that's like with The Shining 2001 and The Wall, is that when I bought a different copy of 2001 and attempted to do it and it didn't line up, I freaked out because it was off by like a minute. And then only until I realized that the only sanctioned DVD released by Kubrick is the one that works. Mm-hmm. That the timing of the intermission, what takes place in the middle of the whole thing, it's a specific timing of that intermission, and all other copies of it have a different timing, which is just fucking weird. Mm-hmm. You know, I could probably find excuses for why later versions work better, but it's the only one, you know, okayed by Kubrick. It's the only version that's letterbox, you know. Mm. So whatever. It's funny that we both ran into that whole timing as it relates to specifically commercially released versions and mm-hmm. how it gets altered throughout the years, and these sort of formulas don't work all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. That you went back to the original LP timing, and that's what worked, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had to do that with other things, too.
That's incredible. And then with the Wall, you know, that's another album that is completely circular.
Mm-hmm. That it, oh, yeah. This is where we come in.
Yeah.
That's like at the very end, it says, this is where.
But
and then at the very beginning, it says, we come in.
In the lag with the technology, there is a little period of silence between that. Mm-hmm. But in the movie, it fits perfectly of when Hal is looking at Frank and Bowman talking without sound.
Mm-hmm.
So it mirrors the whole, I don't know, figure out, you know, decide what you want of that. But at least when that little flip over happens, when there's a break, it's a perfect match when the sound goes completely dead when they're in their little space capsule. Yeah, I gotta watch the three albums for The Shining. It's the complete Shining, right?
Yeah, so the version of The Shining that I use is the, 144 minutes. It was the, which seemed to be like the, for the U.S. anyway, the standard release at the time, before it, that's before the cuts. So that's the version that I have. Wish You Were Here. And then ending it with, you flip the record right when it, the I did it all with vinyl. So the first flip is, when he's talking about the Jet Set before anyone knew what the Jet Set was, which is The Beautiful People, which is a song that the Beatles did, The Beautiful People. And then, Marilyn Manson did The Beautiful People, which goes with Jesus Christ Superstar, with his Antichrist Superstar in a very potent way. But anyways, it's referring to the Jet Set, which is people who would just take jets wherever the fuck they wanted because they were so rich and they just fly around in jets, you know, the super upper class. But then she said royalty, like who has stayed here, you know? And she's like, royalty, and he's like, all the right people.
Yeah.
He's like, all the people have a cigar. Flips to Danny throwing the darts, and so immediately it's like completely on point. And then when that ends, it's An American Prayer, which is made after Jim Morrison died, with a recording that was done on December 8th, his birthday, and the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, and the day that John Lennon was killed, is when he recorded that poetry, which the Doors then proceed to. It's not a mistake when you look at the names of the songs. The album itself is like basically conjuring the spirit of Jim Morrison. It's the ghost song. Right, it's like basically a you know, like what I just said. So you basically, you have that comes in right when she walks in and she's like talking about storms coming, and he's like, what do you want me to do about it? And she's like, what is it, I'm trying to remember the lines of The Shining. He's like, I just want to finish my work. So it's like right when he says, I just want to finish my work, that's An American Prayer. And so you play that through, and then it's, and then after that, it's The Doors 13. So which is, I've been away, Lloyd, now I'm back. Or it's the, so the album starts when he goes into the Gold Room the first time. You flip the album when he returns to the Gold Room and says, I've been away and now I'm back. And so that, and then that's Light My Fire. And then after that is The Doors 13. And so with my issue with Vimeo, I started halfway through thereabouts with The Doors 13. And that's actually what you can watch on Vimeo. But the rest of it I've been meaning to do for quite a while. But you can still watch it. It's one of those things where it's like, I don't play it like digitally, just like letting it play. I do it the LP way, so that there's other examples of this too with sync albums with films, where there's like almost like clues in between where you'd flip the record that like I use. So sometimes the timing's slightly off. One example of that is A Momentary Lapse of Reason with The Land Before Time. That when you flip the record, there's actually a slight change. And it's when Sarah, the Triceratops, says, well, at least we wouldn't have to be alone. There's a reoccurring thing with basically being alone, where I'll find that there's a recurrence in films where that's actually something, some variant of that is actually said right when you flip the record. It's like a reoccurring thing of not wanting to be alone. Very strange, but anyways, yeah.
No. Yeah, that's heavy, man.
Yeah, it is. That one's one of the best. One of the very best syncs is actually, I won't put it up because I feel like it would call too much attention and would probably get taken down because it's Disney.
So, yeah.
So Fantasia with a band called Visual Audio Sensory Theater, which I say band, but it's really just one person doing all this layered instrument stuff who's, you know, just in fucking incredible. But his debut album, Visual Audio Sensory Theater, goes in sync better than almost anything I've ever seen with anything else with Fantasia, where you can see he's speaking directly to what's going on, and then every song change with every scene change, especially the second half, is just fucking phenomenal. If you want to do that, you can only, it only works with the VHF version, which they never reproduce with the digital. So when they digitally redid it, they changed everything, and so it gets completely thrown off. And then when you look at the time frame of when the album came out in the 90s, there was no change in that yet. All you had was the VHS. So the standard VHS version of Fantasia that came out in the 90s with the band Visual Audio Sensory Theater, when you start it over, which is where it gets really good, is the album begins exactly 7 seconds before they show you the eclipse as the dinosaurs are dying. So, which is signaled by the camera pans, and then there's a dinosaur skeleton, and they zoom in on this brontosaurus skull. And right at the moment that the camera stops on the skull, that's when the album begins. So you have it like play, pause, blink, blink, zero, zero. Start it right at that second. And then if you look at the timing, if you have like a CD player, it'll say 7 seconds at the moment that the eclipse shows up. And then it's just fucking flawless. So, yeah, highly, highly, highly recommended. It might sound like a lot of trouble, but it's fucking incredible.
Yeah, you know, the trouble, to me, the trouble of it is the first hurdle, because you put the time and effort into the trouble and you're like, this better fucking work. And you're more inclined to want it to work. You know, if it's not just spoon-fed to you, if you actually get the materials, assemble the whole thing, you're more open to it. So that just speaks to the work involved with the whole equation. So I don't know. With the two movie thing, it becomes even more complicated because you have to arrange, you know, two different screens and whatever. But
yeah. Well, this particular thing with Visual Audio Sensory Theater, otherwise known as VAST, it was more verified later when I saw that he came out with an album called Nude, which is goes in sync with Dune to an incredible degree, which is just an obvious anagram. You're like, Dune, Nude, okay, let's try it. But still not as good as fucking Fantasia. That's superb. So, you know, a lot of people have tried to play things with Fantasia, talking about like Pink Floyd and stuff and mixing up the song. They like mix up metal. They like had metal, but they changed all the song arrangements to be different and stuff and whatever. I mean, it's fun. Everything will go in sync to some degree, but there's something, you know, super special that happens sometimes.
Yeah. I think Andras Jones, his enthusiasm for it really captured it well, and that he's, you know, when he was describing how he found the Matrix, Lifehouse Matrix, that yeah, everything works, but some work better than others, and it's stumbling. And I think finding your own that elevates itself into that realm is really what kind of puts you into that beautiful mind space of just questioning everything around you at that point.
Right. Well, that, I mean, you think about the timing of that when that would, if, you know, somehow that was intentional, that would be the Wachowski brothers. Like, that's the thing, is that almost every single one of these, I think I've come out with like 13 that I would stand behind and be like, holy fuck, look at this. You know, the albums come out after the films in almost all cases, very rare exceptions. So one exception is Saucerful of Secrets and The Dark Crystal, which, but then you're like, well, fucking Dark Crystal is Jim Henson and Frank Oz. You know,
they have a puppet named Floyd in their band. I mean, those were some pretty heavy cats.
Floyd Pepper.
Sergeant Floyd Pepper.
Right. So, you know, it's just, and he's a huge fan of Sid Barrett in particular, you know, Jim Henson. So that's interesting.
You know, that email that, Douglas Bowles sent out, for their 55th episode of 42 Minutes, which is another great show. You can find all their episodes over at syncbook.com. But he is trying to get everyone involved and fans to go see the movie Cloud Atlas, which right. is the new Wachowski brother movie. And I immediately thought, with a movie like that, I like to go in and listen to music and watch it first before I actually watch the actors and the movie. But I still haven't been able to pinpoint an album that I would like to introduce to it, you know? So I was wondering if there were, in your head right now, if there was anything that you would connect to Cloud Atlas. And I have very, very little familiarity with the book, with the project itself.
There's a band called Cloud Atlas, I think. Hold on. I got a sticker on my record case here.
I know a band called Cloudland Canyon that does some pretty amazing work.
I covered it up. Oh, no, it's Cloud Archive. There's a band called Cloud Archive.
I immediately thought of Obscured by Clouds as being sure. a possible candidate.
Obscured by Clouds. That's perfect. I love that album.
And, you know, traditionally, I do like to... I am a fan of letting an album repeat multiple times over a viewing.
Sure.
Just for the cyclical nature, it destroys the linearity of a film and allows you to get under the surface and just realize these are just fractals just spinning off of each other, spinning off of each other. If you think it's just one story from beginning to end, then, you know, that's just a very convenient, or not a convenient illusion, it's just one way to see something. But if you allow an album to spin cycle continuously throughout a movie, it's surprising how you can fall into all these different little sub-stories, and then at the end of it, you can have your own little entire journey through it. So Obscured by Clouds definitely seems to be leading the candidates right now, but I don't know. We'll see. Is that something you think you would go out and see in the theaters because of the people involved? Yeah.
Fuck yeah. Yeah, we just went and saw The Master the other night, and it was a preview at the beginning, and we were just like, oh my God. But, you know, like, those guys, I mean, you know that woman who wrote The Matrix, her version of it called The Third Eye?
That's the one who did The Terminator, right?
I told you about, know about that. Mm-hmm. But they settled. So, like, she won that, basically. Like, at least the acknowledgement, even though it wasn't, you know, it was only publicized to the degree because they wanted to keep that down. They're the same story, Terminator and The Matrix. The Terminators build The Matrix, basically. The machines that take everything over. And it's all based on the Book of Revelations. So that, basically, you have the first part, you know, is literally the beast taking everything over. And then you have... Neo is the redeemer. He's the savior, and so he shows up and fixes everything, basically, or at least the Apocrypha, you know. And so she's like a new agey Christian lady, you know, and she's black. It's a black woman wrote the Terminator and the Matrix,
the Oracle,
screwed twice. So the people who did Terminator fucking stole her idea. Basically, they turned her down when she brought them the whole screenplay or her deal, and after that they proceeded to make it the way they wanted to, because they didn't want to deal with her like being too, you know, wanting it to be this way and keeping it this Christian kind of thing. They wanted to veer away from the new agey aspect of it, but they liked the premise, and so that was the first part. And then when she brought the Wachowski brothers the second part, they turned her down and then proceeded to make it themselves. She just got fucked, you know. So, but the films came out and they're great. And but it's interesting because it's you know, was at that time when she challenged it. It was six films, three for each.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. So, and they ran with it, you know. But yes. But so, I like that. I like to think about the tie, the link between Terminator and the Matrix, and consider that these are a single story. I think that that's really a cool approach to it, you know.
And is the Oracle maybe an unconscious homage to her?
Could very well be, and who knows about how unconscious it is. I mean, I could definitely see that, you know.
Yeah, no, like I think of Alan's squares that touch and how that reflected upon that sinky show on Fox called mm-hmm. Touch.
Mm-hmm.
And just how, I mean, that's the weirdest thing about the internet is that anyone is just as close to these ideas as we are to them. That, you know, people in Hollywood don't have to wait for people to submit scripts to get stuff to steal from. They just got to log on, go into any message group, go into any forum, go into any podcast, and they're just, it's like 49ers panning for gold, you know? How are you going to prove that they didn't listen to a podcast, hear an idea, and say, that would make a great movie and make a fucking movie? Mm-hmm. You got to be really careful if you're going to do stuff like that. Christopher Knowles had a script. I feel bad for him because he actually had a script that he shopped around that is basically reflects itself completely in a movie that was done like 6 years later. That it, I imagine he could probably build a very good case as to, I mean, he shopped it around. I mean, he has a whole article about it, and it's pretty depressing because it feels like he got completely ripped off. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, you know, it's a free for all. So I don't know.
Totally. We watched a Kevin Spacey film last night called Father of Invention, which is basically just that. He's an inventor, and he shows his invention plan to somebody, and they just take it, basically. And there's not really much you can do, necessarily. Like, you know, you have to... I mean, this woman who challenged these directors, she had an extremely good case. She had document showing that she had met with both of these people before they made these films. She has a script which is proven to be written before. It's like all of these things add up, you know. But you have to pay for, you know, can't just challenge people with nothing, you know. Other, like, you know, it's a tricky thing. So, yeah.
You can't petition the directors with prayer.
I have a hopeful vision of the future where none of this, that creativity is happening in such a way, and that economics are in such a way that none of this matters, and it's all just like creation, like the mask of God, where you just, none of that is the point. The point is the information, and the point is the creativity. And, you know, I haven't contributed to that blog in a few months, you know, because I've just been, got focused on the sync book, and then I got way focused on my art, which I've been working on. So I just, you know, but when you're contributing to something like that, and you can see, like, you can recognize, if you know, like, you're like, okay, well, Jason Barrera is doing 80% of this, you know, or whatever. I mean, I think, I don't even know that for sure, but I get that feeling, you know. But it's just that it doesn't matter, like, there's no like signature at the bottom generally, you know, it's just like whatever. So,
yeah, I mean, when we initially were asked to join up with them and we all kind of piled into a work, I think we discussed this and it's minor, but I was a little surprised by, you seem to have an insistence that like, this is my voice, and I want my name attached to the section that I write. And I had to ponder what your intention was. And I didn't consider it as something egocentric, but I more was thinking of it as something like, I don't want to speak for the other people. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't want you to think that I'm speaking. And then eventually it just all melted into just one long post. And like you said, you can, anyone who's familiar with that blog can kind of identify who is where in that article.
Well, I didn't even realize that that's what they did at that time.
Okay.
I wasn't sure how they worked with that.
Well, exactly. So I didn't know what you knew, but I had to sit with that and try to understand this person that I was getting to know. I was like, it doesn't seem like David that he would feel compelled to attach his name to this group effort. Like, I had, you know what I mean? Like, there was just a communication breakdown there. And all I was left was what was presented to me, and it stuck out as something. And the
right,
way it all
part of it too is just that if you're working on a certain line, like the issue is like with my blog, it's like a whole chain, and one post connects to the other, connects to the other, connects to another, and it's a stream of consciousness that all fits into one kind of it's all one network. And so, like, part of where I was coming from was also not just the name, it was also the fact that the name is literally a link. So that if there is this set of information, I didn't feel that it was complete unto itself. And even though I'm contributing to a larger whole in its own right as the Mask of God, I wanted to kind of, like, you know, at least, like, in the cyber realm, like, create a way to if somebody was actually to be interested enough to read all of this and then continue on, like, the fucking rabbit hole. Here's a link to the rest of my rabbit hole that I've been working on.
Absolutely.
Like, all part of it. And so, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, I was, when I first put my blog up, way back when, and I didn't know, I was just mainly doing it for myself to sort out my own thoughts and stuff, because it was a medium to do that. I could lay everything out just because it was what was happening in my head. And so it was like, okay, well, here's a way to communicate it. You know, I didn't, like, I have a few friends of mine, one in particular, that just, I was like, what the fuck? Like, I had written all this stuff out and then had all these links and all this stuff. And I'm talking to a friend of mine. Turns out, not only did he read my entire blog, but he read all my links. Like, he had done all the research and he got way into it. And he was like, hey, thanks for that. And I was just like, wow. Like, I put that out there, and I didn't even realize the degree to which some people are going with this. When I look at my blog and I see that I have over 20,000 views, you know, I think, well, you know, how many of those people are just, like, perusing it, and how many of those people are, and it's not that, none of that is up to me. Like, none of that is up to me to worry about. Like, you know, Jason at the Sync Cabin was mentioning, he's like, well, you know, who reads my blog, like, how many people read my, and I'm like, none of that is up to you. Like, you, all you do is you do what you do, and, like, like, it's out of your hands at that point. Like, but I like to set things up so if somebody wants to continue on with something, it's all right there, you know?
What I love about those blogs, too, is that because of the content that we put in and because of the imagery that we put in, you know, I saw the stats on my blog jump. I was like, oh, people are really into it. But then I realized, for me, I had images of Rubik's Cubes, that became the go-to image whenever you Googled Rubik's Cube. Mm-hmm. So I love the fact that someone completely unsuspecting who just wants to look up something about Rubik's Cubes, they're going to see this writing underneath, and maybe 0.1% of the people over the next 5 years who randomly Google Rubik's Cube and look at the image, if 0.1% of those people just, what the hell is this, and go into that writing, that to me is as magical as it gets. You know what I mean? Because who knows who it's going to... I mean, the message in the bottle is out there in the ocean, and it's really something else. And for as long as the internet exists as we know it, it's going to be there. It's twisted.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the first time I read your blog, I mean, I was into it, and I'm deeply into this, and it just kept going and going, and my brain wanted to keep up with the thread, but it just was like, I got to come back to this. I got to come back to this. And I had to learn how to read your blog. Like, I had to scan it, focus in on certain points, go back to it, find other points, and then eventually the whole post comes together, and like you said, it does bleed into the next post, and just like... I mean, there's nothing else like it I mean, it's not film, it's not book, it's not, I mean, it's a new medium. It's
interacting with the mediums that are already here that other people are playing with for themselves. So like any film or any music is a creative act that the artist has a particular kind of connection to. And so the fact that we're kind of conditioned and programmed through those people's creative expressionalism, like it like gives us a means to communicate back in a way, or at least to kind of like sort out the information. So like if I, you know, I've been doing tarot readings for years, about 10 years. And before I give a reading to anybody, you know, I gave myself a tarot reading every morning for over 6 years, no matter what. Like it was like a thing, like I give myself a reading. So, but when before I give someone else a reading, I emphasize, I do like a disclaimer where I'm like, I don't do fortune telling. This is only meant as a means to communicate. It's to basically get an overview representation of things, and so that you can basically with archetypes in order to gain an understanding. But it's not like I don't doubt that it's possible that, you know, people do that and it works in that way. But that's not what I do. I just try to gain a perspective and use it as a tool to gain a perspective. And so Sync, I look at it in the same way, where it is a tool to gain an understanding of something, creative interplay. And you're relating to that artist in your own way through that. It becomes an interactive thing rather than a spectator thing, because who wants to just be a spectator, you know?
I don't want to put you on the spot, but I had a thought in my head this morning because I realized that we were... this is episode 22
of
Always Record. And I don't know your aesthetics with it, but how long does a tarot reading last? And could you conceivably give me a tarot reading through this media? Or would it not be appropriate, or would it lose its dynamics?
I've been asked to do that a few times before over the phone to do, and I've said no, because I like the personable, laying the cards out, the one-on-one scenario with that. It's but I like, you know, when I do a reading, I never touch the cards myself.
I love that. Okay.
And like, it's a whole process, you know. I also treat it kind of like personal for people too. I mean, so there'll be people around and stuff and they're watching it, but it's really just, it's hard to focalize it in the same way. I mean, I suppose it could be done and it's fine, but it's not my preference. So
that's what I would have, you know, for assumption's sake, that's what I would figure. But I figured I'd mention it. And do you stick to a certain deck primarily?
I have gone back and forth. Initially, it was a Thoth deck, and then I went to the Rider-Waite deck for quite a while, and I went back to Thoth. So I was working out a lot of the rationale for how the specifics of the Thoth deck. It was a turnoff when I, I'm looking at Crowley and all this stuff, and then I find out his involvement with Her Majesty's Secret Service and his part in the Lusitania, and the fact that Lady Frieda Harris was also involved in the propaganda side of that, which is just fucking weird. So she it's her deck more than it is his in many ways, but I've come to relate to it in a way that's kind of like open. I think it is something in the design of it is open to personal interpretation, and you can work with it however you want to. And I don't even know completely where he's coming. Assumptions. I wouldn't call him evil, you know. I know you wouldn't even begin to suggest such a thing, but even depending on your interpretation of what evil is, like melancholia when Kirsten Dunst's character, Aunt Steelbreaker, says that the Earth is evil. You know, I feel like there's something to be said for, you know, the terms can be kind of like reestablished in what it is that's being communicated. You know, something that's evil, anything that's kind of like going against its truest nature in any deviation could be considered evil. And considering that's most of our existence, inevitably, you know, although you can't escape the true will no matter what the appearance is too at the same time. And so there's multiple sides to it. It's not an easily ascertainable thing.
You know, but really, evil, the crisis of our history right now is the things we programmed our children to believe out of safety. But then once you got to safety, how do you unprogram it?
Right.
Because those children grew up to be adults who raised children who grew up to be adults, and they forgot that this was just a safety measure. It's the whole, you cross the ocean in a boat, but you don't carry it on your shoulders across the land. You give up the boat. But the boat has somehow become, you know, attached to the person. It's that whole, what's that great, the Montauk incident about the ship that they make go back in time, and then it comes back, and all the poor naval men are embedded in the steel of the ship. You know that whole story?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that to me is just, you know, trying to relate what we're doing. Something like literacy is programmed into people as this is the way you get out of the slums and you get a job and you get money and you get freedom. But then what did literacy do to our brains, and how do you let go of literacy? How do you allow it to be unprogrammed? And they just, protective parents just programmed the children too well, but they didn't have the instruction booklet to unprogram it. So evil as a thing, is it real? Well, for kids, there is evil out there for kids. You know, they're very vulnerable. But when they grow up, how do they accept that it was never really real? It was just a possibility. So I don't know. I mean, that's
right. I mean, evil could say self-seeking at the expense of everything else, depending on how you want to, you know, express things. So, and then also there's ignorance, and then there's things that are done with full knowledge. So depending on where one is coming from, it's like, it's one thing if somebody does something just based on pure ignorance, but if they're aware of what they're doing and they're doing it anyway, and it's completely selfish, despite all their awareness on the nature of self and what they're dealing with, that's where it gets tricky. And that's the only reason why I would say, depending on where Crowley's coming from, you're like, this is somebody with so much knowledge, has a huge knowledge base. And so if you look at things that are done for patriotism that are just completely self-serving or at the expense of everyone else for something that's superficial or whatever, you know, then that's where things are called into question. And so, like, I feel like that's where things get tricky. I'm not taking the approach of whatever it was that happened, however many, what was that, in March or something of last year, where there was that proposed thing on somebody's teacher basically referring to Crowley as maybe he had a pact with evil or something, and then we go on for fucking 3 days about, like, taking that from every angle. I'm not saying something quite simple, like, you know, what, like, considering that, first of all, off, that the description is not the described, and whatever it is that we're describing, don't get lost in the words and assumptions about what those words mean, you know, it's just, it's pretty straightforward. So, you know, it's like, but who knows in the greater picture, and how, like, this is the thing, like, I'm driving in San Jose the other day here, and I don't know, anyways, and I see a police car with an obvious thulemic symbol and upside down 7-pointed star, and it's just like, and I say to my girlfriend that's an example of something that, like, I honestly feel is not a fucking mistake. Like, I honestly look at that and I'm like, the book of the law, like, what is the rationale for the book of the law, other than, like, if you squash the people underfoot, if you if you, in people's search for power, you go to repress. What comes out of that? You can only repress for so long before the people are like, fuck that. And like, if you don't try and assert to take away people's freedoms in the name of freedom, people never fight. Like, people never claim anything. And so if you want the people to be self-governing, if you want people to rule over themselves, you're never going to get that. Apparently, like, this is the rationale. I don't know how true it is, but I think the assumption is that you won't get that without the attempt do anything unless they're provoked, generally, at least on the scale that we'd like to see it with what's happening with the population and everything. Like, when you reach a certain critical mass and you still want people to be self-governing, how is that going to come about except by threatening every freedom that they've ever had? And so when you look at a police car and you see the symbol of Thelema, like, as in plain sight as it can be, it feels like that's the rationale. Somebody fucking out there, like, you know, possibly unconsciously, but I feel like it's not that big of a stretch when you look at the time frame of when we came up with that symbol for police officers, you know, as we see it today, you know, that they're like the law. It's like a law.
You look at the American flag, right? And the American flag is the unfolded glory. It's old glory. But we haven't reached that glory yet. What the true American flag now is, you have the stars and the stripes. But the stripes are the bars that keep the stars as individuals. So you move all those bars into the blue, and you divide it into the 50 individual states.
Mm-hmm.
And those little individual cells are supposed to grow their own star, their own king. You don't have one. You don't have the greatest man in America. You have the greatest man in Illinois, the greatest woman in Indiana. You have the greatest person in all those 50 states. And once all those states have grown their star or their king, that's when the bars can be freed, the states can be freed, and instead of having these 50 states, you have the starry sky.
Right.
That's the operation that flag represents. But the flag is not yet complete. So,
well, they say that the red bars are the blood, right? And that the white is what? I don't know. I forget. We went over this in school, and we pledged it every day. But in my school, we pledged it with the Christian flag. You have the Christian flag right there, which is the same colors. With the red cross, I believe. I should know. Or it's white and red, I guess. I don't know. I can't remember. But it's a whole... I don't know. It feels like the flag is supposed to represent sacrifice and all these things, you know. But it's definitely... It was originally a corporate symbol. I need to look that up again. I couldn't... I went to look it up, and I couldn't find it fucking anywhere. Even though it was shown to me about 8 years ago, something, how the American flag was originally a corporate symbol, like early corporate symbol, the money symbol, kind of crazy.
Well, in that red state, blue state, White House motif of getting all 50 states blue, you know, with the 50 different stars in each individual cell, what do you have as the opposite as of this day? Well, what is the Chinese flag? It's all red and a star, or one star? So that I'm just off of my own head right there. But that seemingly are the two directions this world could... Oh, geez, well, there you go. Fuck. I mean, those are the two directions that the world leader could go at this place. America could grow up into the stars and stripes, old glory, or it can just be bought out and forgotten by the Chinese symbol, which is all red severity with one large star and four small stars in yellow.
Yeah.
But the people have to the people have to make it work. The people have to, in each section, recognize the freedom that is involved there. I mean, there's just so much bitching and complaining in this country, but the resources that we have are so monumental right now. God, I wonder what the perspective from the top is of this whole affair right now. People who really...
They're afraid.
You think
they're
they are?
At the top, and they're afraid below. And the people at below are afraid of the people on the top. Even they're fighting the people on the top is an expression of their fear of the people on the top. The people on the top are simultaneously afraid of the people on the bottom and what they'll do to shake them from their comfort. And so, like, it's all, like, it's all reflecting upon itself in that way. And the whole thing seems to be ready for a breakdown, which, like, which it's doing already, despite any appearance. So, like, I feel like, you know, I do this whole synthesis of the Book of the Law and an American prayer. And it feels to me like the contrary take on it. So you have this kind of like rationalization, poetic expression, supposedly channeled communication from Crowley through Lom of the basically his feeling about world power and all of that, and basic like rationale, and that Morrison's response to that is that instead of kind of like pushing what the law is, which is because the idea is that every eon there's a new law. And that during there's a transition period where everything is malleable, more malleable, but that eventually gets solidified into the foundation for the next eon. And that the Old Testament was one expression of this, of a shift in the ages, and that this is a formulation of a law, not just the text itself is a living text that goes beyond what you see written. And then the New Testament, same thing through Rome. And that basically right now we're at a pivotal point where we're approaching this new eon, and we have to basically access and do whatever needs to be done in order to formulate whatever this new eon's set of laws are. And so an American prayer is like a response to, it's like the other side of a caduceus or something that's twining with it, and it's coming at it from more of a very poetic, but it's like a literally an intentionalized view of things rather than just an authoritarian, this is what it is, and that actually the two are mutually interdependent. And so the Book of the Law is very much like Gevura, whereas an American prayer is very much Chesed. And so they're like basically having an interplay that you can't have one without the other. And so I definitely like that's how I like relate to it and feel that there's something to be said for that.
Yeah, I mean, I've read your post on that and seen that, and it seems to me that you're the first person to really put that out there, that connection.
It's weird that the book is, that an American prayer is written the way that it is, because I mean, I have a copy. Not the whole thing laid out in the original handwriting, but they give the first pages in the original handwriting. You can see that every time there's a break in the print between stanzas, that is actually a line on the paper that Morrison did. So it's all sectioned out. So it was just the result of counting the sections and then realizing that this is the same amount or close to it, because I skip a line at the beginning, which I feel like there's definitely rationale and explanation for. But that basically the first section of the Book of the Law is written in, everyone is numbered. And the way that it's written is just very similar in that way. So I don't know, it's kind of crazy. But the book, An American Prayer, has got all these blank pages. The privately published book that he only did so many copies of and gave it to his closest friends or whatever. And this is actually kind of weird, because when I looked it up, the place where I found this out at, that there's actually a total of 77 pages where it's, unevenly this place with blank and written, that, you know, the copy that I found that out from was actually from Aptos, which is the town where I grew up. So this guy was like a composer who had a copy of the book. And then I happen to see that after I'm looking at it, and I'm like looking at the number of pages, and I'm like, oh, this guy lives down the street from me. I was thinking about talking to him, you know, seeing if I could look at the book, you know, because he has it. But, you know, I don't know. I could look it up again and try and contact him, but it's kind of weird.
Yeah, very, very. Yeah, there's a lot going on right there. Are you going to vote?
Should. I'm having an issue because I moved and I never put down my change of address with the post office. Which also I should go down and do that, because I think I've been probably getting, who knows, I might be getting jury duty stuff and all sorts of things. But it's been 2 years now since I've been away from that address, so I haven't gotten any mail. And it doesn't matter beyond that, like beyond voting and beyond jury duty as far as mail's concerned, because anybody I'm getting mail from, I'm giving the address to now. And everything else is junk mail for the most part, which I have a ton of. And so I don't really give a fuck about that. But you know, I should do it so the people who live there now don't have to deal with it. But I'd have to go to the clear. I'd have to, you know, it's not that big of a deal, but I'd have to drive quite a ways and find out where I'm actually supposed to go for that. You know, I don't have an absentee ballot thing. So, but my girlfriend's going through reading all the props and doing the whole thing and going to the trouble to see everything. And it's just like, Jesus Christ, it's like impossible. Like, the only thing I really care about is the props, because in all honesty, I feel like the rest is rigged. Honestly, like, I think I posted it to you, actually, this whole guy going on the stand talking about, I think it was a governor, that he designed a program to manipulate the votes. And he went before all this committee of people. Did you watch that?
Yeah.
Hammer. Yeah, and so, like, what the fuck? Like, why on earth not at this point? Like, you can make a program for fucking anything. You can tip anything in your fucking favor. And then I come and I find out, like, just super straightforward that fucking Ron Paul was shortly behind Mitt Romney in terms of the caucuses, right? And then it's just like, there's whole cities that there's no account for what they basically were. All these people voted. Incredible amount of votes, just unaccounted for. And it's just like, oh, sorry, you don't exist. It's like whole cities that just don't exist all of a sudden. And it's like, what the fuck, dude? Like, Ron Paul could have very well have just actually won that. And that there was just like, oh, sorry. And so I don't know. I think that there's something to be said for voting on the propositions, which is the main reason why, if I do go to the trouble real soon to figure that out, I might, you know.
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, when Al Gore just lied down and said, you know what, we don't need to take this further. I'll just allow it to be, you know, when he lost to Bush the first time, when it seemed clear that everything in Florida was fucked up. I mean, they spend more time trying to get a bad football call right than they did with that election, you know? Mm-hmm. So
it's somewhere in Florida, votes are still being counted.
You know, it seems like a whole onion story, but yet it's real and just twisted.
Yeah.
So...